2014 Sun Summit Symposium at the University of Utah. My name is J. Seth Anderson. I go by Seth. I'm the chair of this panel.
Sure.
Is that better? So I'm J. Seth Anderson. I go by Seth. I'm the chair of this panel today. I'm excited to be here. Thank you for coming out and being here at this early first session. Just to do some double checking, this is session 114, titled Two Jesuses in the Book of Mormon and Other Anomalies. Just make sure that's in the right place you're supposed to be. Like the first day of school. I'd like to just remind you to please turn off your cell phones for now so there's no interruptions for our presentation. And if you haven't already had a chance to check out the bookstore down the hallway, please do. There's a ton of great books there. And since we're here early, you get first pick before everything's gone. I'll also remind you that these sessions are being recorded. That includes the Q&A that we're going to have some time for at the end. So that'll be recorded. There's the mic, so please speak into the mic loudly. And now, I'm very picky about ending on time, so we will end right on time. Since I'm in charge, I get to do that. So I will, my pleasure to introduce our presenter today, Earl Wunderly, who is a native of Salt Lake City, product of Longfellow Elementary, Bryant Junior High, and East High. He has an AB degree in philosophy and a JD degree, both from the University of Utah. And he's the author of a new book titled An Imperfect Book, What the Book of Mormon Tells Us About Itself. That is on sale down the hallway if you haven't had a chance to pick up a copy yet. So it is my pleasure to introduce our wonderful legal for hearing what he has to say.
That is, the Book of Mormon is not going to change. Well,
has been tweaked over the years, but these changes can all be discovered by comparing whatever edition we're using in the Book of Mormon with the first edition. I also like the internal facts because I can access them without any special training, like a linguist, or searching through libraries like a historian, or dealing with the latest discoveries like an archaeologist. And I like that when I cite a fact, I'm comfortable that it cannot be challenged, or that it can be readily verified. So as interesting as the external evidence is, and it is, my paper deals with just what we can learn from studying the book itself. I intend to cover five anomalies this morning, and a couple of anomalies within them. The first one relates to the language used by Jesus, and the second to the language used by the three major writers, Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni. The third anomaly relates to the prophecies, made mostly by Nephi, but also by others. The fourth and fifth are the shortest and relate to the proper names, and the long generations. I don't have a PowerPoint presentation. I'm going to have to ask you to picture in your mind the Book of Mormon as we go along here. And I think you all are familiar with the Book of Mormon. It starts with the Book of Nephi, and the minor writers after him for about 470 years. And then the abridgments by Mormon take over for, I don't know, next 600 years, down to his son Moroni, who finishes the book with the Book of Ether and his own Book of Moroni. And we'll be coming back to that as I go through my paper. As perhaps all of you know, the Book of Mormon is essentially a 1,000-year history of a group of Israelites who leave Jerusalem in 600 BCE, before the Common Era. They split into two groups, the faithful Nephites and the rebellious Lamanites. The two sides constantly war with each other, culminating in a final civil war around 400 CE, Common Era, in which the Nephites are wiped out and the Lamanites survive as Native Americans. A little after the middle of this 1,000-year history, Jesus visits the people after his resurrection, and we have a record of his teachings in the book of 3rd Nephi. During his visit, Jesus gives to the Nephites the Sermon on the Mount that he had given to the Israelites as recorded in the book of Matthew in the King James Version of the New Testament. In fact, that's where the sermon seems to come from in the Book of Mormon. It parallels very, very closely what's found in the Book of Matthew. It consists of about 2,500 words. Jesus also preaches much else, consisting of about 8,000 words, not counting his quotations of Isaiah and other biblical sources. There is a major anomaly in Jesus' teaching. The Jesus who gives the Sermon on the Mount, whom I will call the biblical Jesus, differs from the Jesus of his remaining teachings, whom I will call the Book of Mormon Jesus. There is a lot of evidence of their differences. I will mention three of their differences. First, the Book of Mormon addresses the people as O House of Israel. He does this five times before the biblical Jesus gives the Sermon on the Mount, and 14 times after the Sermon on the Mount. Although he is speaking to the same audience, the biblical Jesus never addresses the people as O House of Israel, or as anything else during his sermon other than as you, or some substitute such as ye or thou. A second difference is that the biblical Jesus uses the personal, your father, thy father, our father, and my father, and often couples father with which is in heaven. In contrast, the Book of Mormon Jesus uses only one of these personal addresses. He uses my father 8 times, but uses the less personal, the father, 147 times, and never couples his reference to the Father with which is in heaven. A third difference is a bit more technical and relates to the infrequently used words. More than half the different words in the Book of Mormon are used only three times or less. There are more than 1,500 of these 5,250 different words in the Book of Mormon that are used just once in the entire book. Of these that are used only once, the biblical Jesus uses 38 of them, while the Book of Mormon Jesus uses only 14, even though he is quoted more than three times as much as the biblical Jesus. The biblical Jesus uses one of these words for every 66 words, or more than 7 per page. In contrast, the Book of Mormon Jesus uses one for every 575 words, or less than 1 per page. In other words, the biblical Jesus uses his unique vocabulary nearly 9 times more frequently than the Book of Mormon Jesus does. Uses his. The evidence does not end here. There is other evidence of their differences. I'm going to mention another in a moment. But the two Jesuses are also alike in one significant way. The word verily is used 76 times in the Book of Mormon, and 70 of these 76 uses are found in 3 Nephi, where Jesus gives his Sermon on the Mount. These 70 are always coupled with, "I say unto you," and always in the mouth of Jesus. The biblical Jesus uses the expression 21 times, while the Book of Mormon Jesus uses it 48 and 49 times. Clearly, the two Jesuses are alike in using "verily I say unto you," and they differ from everyone else in the Book of Mormon. As you may have already surmised, the two Jesuses' common use of this idiom may have been by the design of the author, who recognized that the two must sound alike, which is a daunting task to accomplish. The author may have hit on their expedient of using this idiom, which characterizes the biblical Jesus, and used it with abandon, much as an impersonator exaggerates in obvious mannerism. And there is evidence of this. First, the biblical Jesus uses this idiom 5 times in his Sermon on the Mount in the Book of Matthew. These 5 have been retained, but 16 more have been added in the Book of Mormon. This suggests an emphasis on this idiomatic expression. And second, in Matthew, Jesus uses "verily" only singly. But in the Book of Mormon, Jesus uses the double "verily, verily" 8 times. And incidentally, the Book of Mormon, Jesus uses the double "verily, verily" 15 times. In the Bible, Jesus uses a double "verily, verily" only in the Gospel of John and not in Matthew. The double and frequent "verily, verily" also suggests an emphasis. Readers could hardly miss how Jesus sounds the same throughout his visit. I should also note that one of the biblical Jesus' single verities in the Bible has been changed to a double verity in the Book of Mormon. And finally, I'll note that Jesus quotes a passage from Isaiah, whose "therefore" in the Bible has been changed to "verily, verily, I say unto you" in the Book of Mormon. Book of Mormon Jesus attributes this to Isaiah, whom biblical scholars assert is not actually Isaiah at all, but 2nd Isaiah, a pseudepigrapher. But this gets us into external evidence. That was an aside. This idiom, "verily, verily, I say unto you," would seem to serve no purpose other than to make the two Jesuses sound alike. One may wonder whether the author ever anticipated that someone would try to distinguish the two Jesuses. He probably did not, but he did want readers to recognize that "verily I say unto you" was the very voice of Jesus. At least two things can be learned from this exercise, I believe. First, an examination of the words used by writers can distinguish one writer from another, as in the case of the two Jesuses. Or, contrarywise, a close examination of the words used by the several writers can determine whether the writers are the same or different. Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni use the same idiom, the same words and phrases throughout the book. For example, I have identified 27 words that seem to be idiomatic, 9 of which are recognizably biblical. Behold, yea, even, forth, O, cast, hearken, woe, and lest. Nephi, Mormon, and Moroni use them all at about the same rate, even though Mormon and Moroni write more than 900 years after Nephi. It seems unlikely that the idiom would not change over this period, especially when we think back on how much the English language has changed in the past 900 years or so. This is particularly true of words like behold and yea, which are superfluous. The second thing we learn from this exercise, I believe, is that the evidence on verily, verily, I say unto you shows a consciousness on the author's part. This does not square easily with what some scholarly defenders of the Book of Mormon suggest, that the translation is guided by revelation or inspiration or what have you. Okay, let's turn to the second anomaly, also relating to words, but not to a single word like verily, but to two words, therefore and wherefore. Each of them is frequently used, therefore being used over 650 times in the Book of Mormon and wherefore over 400 times. The two words are interchangeable with few exceptions. Together they are ubiquitous, occurring about 2.5 times per page on average. By way of comparison, the phrase "and it came to pass" and its variations, which we associate so much with the Book of Mormon, are used nearly 3 times per page. Therefore and wherefore together are nearly as ubiquitous as "and it came to pass." And here's another difference between the two Jesuses. There are only 6 instances in which "wherefore" cannot be substituted for "therefore," and all 6 instances are in statements made by the biblical Jesus, such as, "After this manner, therefore, pray ye." One cannot say, "After this manner, wherefore, pray ye." Incidentally, this is one more difference between the two Jesuses. The distribution of "therefore" and "wherefore" in the Book of Mormon is fascinating. The main writer, Mormon, uses "therefore" much more than he uses "wherefore," whereas the two other major writers of the Book of Mormon, Nephi and Moroni, who open and close the book, Nephi with the first book of Nephi and Moroni with his own book of Moroni, they open and close the book, use "wherefore" significantly more than "therefore." More specifically, Mormon's abridgments constitute nearly 2/3 of the Book of Mormon and contain 90% of the "therefores" but less than 3% of the "wherefores." The writings of Nephi and Moroni, together with the several minor writers following Nephi, comprise the remaining 1/3 of the Book of Mormon and are just the opposite of Mormon. They use only 10% of the "therefores" versus his 90%, and over 90% of the 97% of the "wherefores" versus his 3%. These data would seem to challenge the notion of a single writer of the Book of Mormon. Indeed, some scholars once considered this as evidence of different writers, but they have since abandoned the idea. The anomaly is in the way "therefore" and "wherefore" are distributed within the writings of Mormon and Moroni. With respect to Mormon, who uses "therefore" overwhelmingly, he uses only "wherefore" in the two things he wrote outside of his abridgments. He wrote "Words of Mormon," the 2-page bridge between the books of Omni, and "Mosiah," and "Mosiah" begins his abridgments. Omni ends the first part of the Book of Mormon. So he wrote that 2-page bridge between the books of Omni and Mosiah. He uses "wherefore" 4 times in Words of Mormon, but no "therefores." In the chapters leading up to the Book of Mosiah, there are 17 pages, including Words of Mormon, containing 30 wherefores, but no therefores. But in the Book of Mosiah, which follows the words of Mormon and begins Mormon's abridgments, the first 28 pages contain 57 therefores without a single wherefore. It seems extremely unlikely that an author would, by happenstance, use 30 straight wherefores and suddenly switch to 58 straight therefores. And we thread with respect to Mormon's other writing outside his abridgments. He wrote two letters to his son Moroni, which Moroni included in his Book of Moroni, the final book in the Book of Mormon. In the Book of Moroni, where Moroni uses only wherefore 27 times, Mormon uses wherefore in his two letters 11 times, and no therefore, sounding just like Moroni and unlike himself throughout his abridgments. This, then, is the anomaly within the writings of Mormon. Outside of his abridgments, in which he uses therefore overwhelmingly, he uses only wherefore in the words of Mormon and his two letters to Moroni, his son. Similarly, in Mormon's individual Book of Mormon, and that's the last book before Moroni takes over and writes the Book of Ether and his own Book of Moroni. So in his individual Book of Mormon, Mormon's final book in which he uses only therefore 17 times, Moroni writes the last two chapters and, like Mormon before him, uses only therefore 4 times. So to recap, wherefore predominates from Nephi to Jacob, at Nephi and Jacob, through Mormon's words of Mormon. Then, beginning with Mormon's abridgments with the Book of Mosiah, therefore predominates right through Mormon's own Book of Mormon, including Moroni's final two chapters of this book. Then, beginning with Moroni's Book of Moroni, including Mormon's two letters, wherefore is used exclusively to the end of the book. In short, what determines which word is used is not the writer, since Mormon, who prefers therefore, uses only wherefore in the words of Mormon and in his two letters to Moroni. And since Moroni, who prefers wherefore, uses only therefore in the last two chapters in Moroni's Book of Mormon. What determines which word is used is where it is used in the book. Remember that after the loss of the 116 pages, Joseph Smith began dictating the Book of Mormon from Mosiah through to the end of the book, ending with Moroni's Book of Moroni, and then returned to the beginning of the book and proceeded from the Book of Nephi through Mormon's words of Mormon. Hope you've all been able to picture that in your mind. I don't have a, whatever that's called. What is it?
PowerPoint.
That's right. Not there yet. Someday. Maybe. So what determines which word is used is where it is used in the book. Remember that I read all that, haven't I? So therefore occurs in the first part of the dictation, beginning with the Book of Mosiah, and wherefore occurs in the last part of the dictation from the Book of Moroni through words of Mormon. What is missing in this summary thus far is the Book of Ether, which follows Mormon's Book of Mormon, individual Book of Mormon, with predominance of therefores, and precedes Moroni's Book of Moroni with exclusively wherefores. It is in the Book of Ether that a changeover occurs from therefore to wherefore. In the first chapter of Ether, therefore occurs twice, wherefore not at all. In the second chapter, each word appears twice. When we arrive at the 10th of 15 chapters, there are no therefores, but 6 wherefores. There are also no therefores in chapters 11, 13, and 14, and only one each in chapters 12 and 15, while each of these chapters uses wherefore. By the end of the Book of Ether, there has been a gradual changeover from a total of 24 therefores to 63 wherefores. All about that. These data demand an explanation, and the easiest one is that just after the writer started the Book of Ether, the writer of the Book of Mormon started the Book of Ether, He recognized that Moroni would be abridging the Jaredite record, and that he and Mormon would somehow have to sound different, just as he recognized in 3 Nephi that the two Jesuses would have to sound the same. He hit on the expedient of substituting wherefore for therefore, two common words that were interchangeable. After slipping several times in the book of Ether, he finally mastered and using therefore only twice in the last six chapters of the book of Ether, while using wherefore 38 times. What this suggests, I believe, like we saw earlier, and with verily I say unto you, is a consciousness on the author's part of what he was doing. The distribution of therefore and wherefore does not seem to be divinely inspired. Let's move to a third anomaly, which does not involve words but prophecies. There are many prophecies. About 40% of them have to do with events in world history that had already occurred when Joseph Smith dictated the book. I'll refer to these as past events. About one-third of relate to events still to occur when Joseph Smith dictated the book. I'll refer to these as future events. The remaining one quarter or so relate to events within the book's narrative, and I'll refer to these as internal events. The anomaly is that the prophecies of past and internal events differ from the prophecies of future events. With respect to the prophecies of past events, they are specific and unconditional, as if born of 20/20 hindsight. They describe events unconditionally destined to occur, as they all in fact had occurred by 1830. An example of prophecies of past events is Lehi's and or Nephi's prophecies that in 600 years the Lord God would raise up among the Jews a Savior of the world, who would be born of a virgin in Nazareth to a woman named Mary, and his name would be Jesus Christ, that he would be baptized in Bethabara beyond the Jordan River, that he would select 12 apostles and heal the sick, that Jews would not believe his gospel and would slay him, and that he would rise from the dead after 3 days. One anomaly within the prophecies of past events is that names and places of sacred history are foreknown, like Mary, Jesus, Bethabara, and Nazareth, but not the names in secular history, like Columbus, who is, quote, a man among the Gentiles, and will discover the promised land, or the Atlantic Ocean, which is, quote, the many waters on which other Gentiles will go forth into the promised land. Prophecies of internal events, by and large, clearly and accurately describe subsequent Book of Mormon history, which had already been dictated when the prophecies were made, such as the appearance of Christ in the Promised Land, the final civil war between the Nephites and the Lamanites, the destruction of the Nephites, and the survival of the Lamanites. Some of the prophecies may be conditional, as when the Lord tells Nephi that inasmuch as ye shall keep my commandments, ye shall prosper and shall be led to a land of promise. Does inasmuch here mean because ye shall keep my commandments, or if ye keep my commandments? There's also an anomaly within this prophecy. The Lord tells Nephi that if his brothers Laman and Lemuel rebel against the Lord, he would curse them with a sore curse. But if Nephi rebels against the Lord, Laman and Lemuel, and presumably their seed, would be a scourge to Nephi's seed to stir them up in the ways of remembrance. This unequal treatment of Laman and Lemuel, on the one hand, a sore curse, and Nephi's seed being stirred up in ways of remembrance on the other, is unexplained but reflects what happened in the Book of Mormon. By and large, the prophecies of internal events, like the prophecies of past events, are specific descriptions of events that subsequently and unmistakably occurred within the Book of Mormon narrative. With respect to the future events, there are two major themes that recur. The first is the restoration of the house of Israel to the lands of their inheritance, which, unlike the prophecies of past events, is conditional, the most explicit of which is Jacob's quoting the Lord. When the day cometh that they, the Jews, shall believe in me, that I am Christ, then have I covenanted with their fathers that they shall be restored in the flesh upon the earth unto the lands of their inheritance. So when the Jews accept Jesus Christ, which is the condition, they will be restored to the lands of their inheritance, that is, Israel. So the present state of Israel is not the promised restoration, but as Marion G. Romney said in 1981 in a general conference address, the state of Israel is a signal that the Jews would soon come to accept Jesus Christ as their Redeemer. The second theme is the carrying forth of the Book of Mormon to the Native Americans and to the rest of the world, which was within the control of Joseph Smith and his followers, such as that when the Book of Mormon comes forth, there shall be many which shall believe the words which are written, and they shall carry them forth unto the remnant of the seed of the people of Nephi, or the Native Americans. Other prophecies of future events are extrapolations of conditions existing in Joseph Smith's time, such as that the Gentiles will not destroy the seed of Nephi's brothers, that is, the Native Americans. Many prophecies are eschatological, describing the end times in familiar Christian terms, such as that the Holy One of Israel numbereth his sheep, and there shall be one fold and one shepherd, and Satan has no power and cannot be loosed for the space of many years. And many of the prophecies are general, whose meaning is unclear, such as Nephi's prophecy of the destruction of all nations that fight against the 12 apostles. What do these terms mean? The prophecies of future events are uninteresting in content, especially when compared with the prophecies of past and internal events. The prophecies of future events stand in sharp contrast to the prophecies of past events, which are largely specific, unconditional, and unambiguous. The prophecies of internal events are not much less so. The difference between specific, accurate prophecies and vague, less accurate prophecies is a key to scriptural scholars in determining the, quote, compositional horizon of when the prophecies were written, which would be in the early 19th century. There appear to be no prophecies that the Book of Mormon author could not have made. The last two anomalies are the shortest. The fourth anomaly occurs in the proper names. According to the Book of Mormon account, Lehi's party consisted of Jews who spoke Hebrew and left Jerusalem for the New World in 600 BCE. The Jaredites, on the other hand, left the Tower of Babel in today's Iraq for the New World in about 2200 to 3100 BCE. Mormon scholars differ on the date of the Tower of Babel. And they spoke an unconfounded language. Scholars disagree on what that is, too. Is it the pure Adamic language? In any case, the two peoples came from different parts of the world, at least 1,600 years apart, and did not interact except for one person, Corion Urge, you can call it, for 9 months and spoke different languages. And yet, they have 7 identical names, which are Aaron, Corionimer, Gilgal, Morion, Nehor, Noah, and either Shiblon or Shiblon. And 14 others that are nearly identical, that is to say, within one letter of each other, like Ahah and Ahah. One of them ends with H. And Abish and Abish change to B to K, and you've got the other name. It seems highly unusual that these two people would share any names. There is much more that can be said about the names, but the identical and nearly identical names of both peoples is sufficient for this morning. I will mention one last anomaly, a fifth one. Several times in the Book of Mormon, the period from Jesus' birth to the final civil war that destroyed the Nephites is stated to be both 400 years and 4 generations. Could the author of the Book of Mormon have equated one generation with 100 years? Possibly. Fourth Nephi notes that after 110 years, the first generation of Christ had passed away, and that after 200 years, the second generation had passed away, except for a few. The author may well have assumed that someone born at the beginning of each new century would live at least 100 years and added their ages together to arrive at four generations or 400 years. But this calculation overlooks the fact that a father's and son's lives would overlap for much of their lives. For example, if a father is 25 when his son is born and dies when he's 72, their lives would overlap for 47 years. If a new generation begins every 25 years or so, 400 years would equal 12 generations, and not 4. Some LDS scholars argue for long lives, and there are some long lives, beginning with the Jaredites. Corianum dies at age 142, he's a Jaredite, and five kings beget children in their old age. Another has a child at an exceeding old age, another at an exceedingly great age, and two others at a good old age. So some Jaredites did live long lives. But in the Nephi history, we have the span from Nephi's younger brother Jacob to Jacob's great-grandson, and that's at least 275 years. From you to your great-grandchild, 275 years. This is 11 generations, according to one Book of Mormon scholar, who equates 50 years with two generations. So that a new generation, then as now, comes about every 25 years or so. But in this line of succession, from Jacob to his great-grandson, if the father of each generation is, say, 50 years old, rather than 25 when his son is born and his wife is still of childbearing age, then according to the dates given in the Book of Mormon, Jacob's son lived to be about 122, Jacob's grandson 131, and the great-grandson 125, even though the Book of Mormon Jesus says that 72 years is the age of man. And finally, turning to the Nephite history following Jesus' visit, Nephi, the son of Nephi, who wrote the third book of Nephi, is one of four writers of the fourth book of Nephi. The generations from this son, Nephi, to his grandson are even longer than those from Jacob to his great-grandson. According to the dates given in the book of fourth Nephi, if the father in each of these generations is 50 years old when his son is born, then the son Nephi lives to be about 96, his son lives to be 130, and Nephi's grandson lives to be 191 years, and Nephi's other grandson lives to be at least 206 years. Their shortest possible lives occur if they are born in the year their father dies, but the mother would be much younger than the father, and the son would have to grow up before he could keep the record. In this scenario, the two grandsons would live to 111 and 126. And believe me, there are enough dates given in the line from Jacob to his great-grandson and from the son of Nephi to his two grandsons for anyone to compute these ages. They are not something I made up out of whole cloth. Okay, we're at the end. There are many more anomalies than these five. They are found from a close examination of the book itself. This is not to say, again, that I do not appreciate external evidence. The many books and articles I've read about linguistics, biographies, history, archaeology, DNA, and so forth are fascinating and by and large reflect good scholarship. This is the kind of evidence most people are familiar with. But none of it seems to be dispositive of the question of how we got the Book of Mormon. What comes closest, I believe, is the internal evidence, which is complete, accessible, unchanging, and certain. In this paper, I've tried to give you a taste of what is available within the book itself. For those of us who do not base their beliefs on faith but turn to evidence, I believe that the internal evidence will play a larger and larger role in our search for the truth. Okay, let's have questions.
Research whether the Jaredites or the Lehi's family sailed across the Pacific or across the Atlantic?
No, I've always... I've seen some recent presentations on the route that the Jaredites and Nephites took, most specifically the Nephites. They're arguing today that the Nephites crossed the Atlantic Ocean and not the Pacific Ocean. In fact, I've seen two presentations on that. But I haven't researched it myself, and I've assumed all along it hasn't been important to me that they crossed the Pacific Ocean, because someone said, I think it was Joseph Smith, they landed on the west coast of South America, and then it was moved up sometime later, but always on the west coast, and so they would have to sail the Pacific. Is that important to you?
I'm curious.
Which route they took? Yeah. Well, those who argue for an Atlantic crossing, and they've got good evidence on it, is that the Nephites then came into the New World on the East Coast, or on Southern America, in the South of America, and they put the events in North America. And I have never seen a satisfactory explanation where the land southward is, which the Book of Mormon says is after a narrow neck of land almost surrounded by water. Colby, you had something, I know. Anyway, anyone else? Yes.
What do you make of the small intermediary books like Omni, where apparently there's not much said in them, it's just a mere passing of time, and it seems to me to lack a certain economy of language, especially when you're pounding on some pretty precious sheets of gold metal?
The same thing can be said of 4th Nephi, of course. That covers several hundred years and a few pages, several hundred years between Jacob on the one hand and the advent of Mosiah some several hundred years later. Same thing, I think, my own opinion, is that they were both bridges from real history to wherever he was going. I mean, from Omni and those small books cover several hundred years. I think that was to get from the sailing of the Nephites and landing and establishment of a culture in the Americas to the main history, and didn't have much to offer. And I think the same way with the 4th Nephi, where Jesus now is gone, and you have to get to the end of the book, find Civil War, and I think those verses in 1st Nephi, or 4th Nephi, was simply to get us there, and didn't contribute a lot to the history. In fact, there have been a lot of complaints about 4th Nephi, that there wasn't a lot more detail, because that was 200 years of communal living that was very peaceful, and scholars would like to know a lot more about that society. That's my opinion on that. Does that answer your question?
Good start.
Yes.
Getting into the wherefores and the therefores, could that have also been an influence of, for example, Alma, who was full of chiasmus and things of that nature in his writings? Could the influence of those writers that in the abridgment have anything to do with why there were more wherefores and therefores in between Alma and
it supports that. By the way, I challenge the chiasmus in Alma. I've done a long article, as a matter of fact, challenging John Walsh's chapter 36 as an extended chiasm. But no, I don't think so. I think that the distribution of therefore and wherefore suggests something other than the influence of Alma or whoever else might have used therefore. I mean, the writers of a Book of Mosiah were really using therefore before we even come to Alma, and then everyone after that uses therefore. So it's a continuous string of therefores right through the abridgments. And then in Ether, it's a changeover to wherefore for the rest of the book. So,
yes.
In your research, have you done an analysis of how many authors wrote in the Book of Mormon or the Bible from the time of the beginning of Jesus until our era, when we have the word, which is our printed word? In other words, we have how many authors hand-wrote Matthew, Luke, all those books up until we got it, and how many authors wrote in the Book of Mormon? Because each author varies from somewhat with their own writing.
No, I have not researched that. That's not strictly internal evidence. So, and of course, the authorship of the of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, and the rest of them were big scholarly debate on just who wrote those. But it wasn't Matthew, Mark, and Luke who wrote those. So, no, I have not done that. What is the point?
The point is if you're comparing the wherefores and therefores, you're not coming from original writers. You're coming from interpretation of authors as they come through time.
Yeah. But still, the distribution just does not support, I think, that conclusion. Colby, do you have something? He's the one going for his PhD soon in religious studies.
With that, though, I would suggest looking. It's on page 114 of his book. You can actually see how clear it is with what form and form of distribution.
But I'm kind of curious. My main question, I have other questions maybe we can chat about them later, but one of my main questions is the use of terms of biblical Jesus and Book of Mormon Jesus. I wonder if it would be better clarified, because if you define what you're discussing as biblical Jesus on page 128 in Book of Mormon Jesus, but I wonder if it would be better, since we are taking a critical approach, if the word is called like something revised in Athenian Jesus or something like that. Do you have any thoughts on that? Well, like, I'm kind of curious why you use biblical Jesus rather than something else.
Well, yeah, I use that simply because that's where it's found. I mean, that's the Jesus of the Bible. And to get into anything other than that gets into external evidence and that. No, so it's just that's where I find that Jesus, and his language is in the Bible, so it's the biblical Jesus. And then you've got the other Jesus, or the Jesus that gave the rest of his sermons while he was in the New World. That answer? No? Okay, good. Yes.
I've always found the Book of Mormon to be a cure for insomnia. How in the world have you spent 50 years studying this in detail?
And 50 years. I found it fascinating. It was a lot longer than I anticipated. As a matter of fact, the initial work was done in 14 years and not 50. And of course, it wasn't constant. I was working and having children and so forth and traveling. But there came a time when I had invested so much time in it that I had to finish it. And I had found a lot of interesting things. I was anticipating that there would be more interesting things, so I stuck with it. But, like Mark Twain said, it's chloroform in print. Anything else?
All convinced?
No. Okay, well, I guess it's close enough. I guess so.